Welcome to tonight's installment of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series.
Yeah, we're out of that.
How many are here for your first Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture? Great. Out of curiosity, how did you hear about us?
We got an email.
Okay.
We don't know where it came from.
Oh, okay. That's various emails. Okay. It's a good marketing technique. Okay. Well, welcome. The food is between you and El Phoenix, but be sure and settle up before you leave. And we do take up a $5 admission. If you want to become a regular, we'll do 6 months for $35, which is almost half price. And see Dr. Alkek over here if you didn't get a chance to pay on the way in. We are a 100% volunteer, nonprofit organization, but we do have certain expenses on the outside and AV equipment and so forth that we take up this collection for. So to those of you new to the drill, we will have a lecture of approximately 45 minutes or so, and then try to leave about half an hour for Q&A. And so we ask you to hold your questions until the end, and to make them in the form of a question and relatively succinct, and we'll try to give everybody a chance to ask the question before we double up on anybody.
Yeah, no dissertations.
Yeah, that's the idea. We try to rotate the topic around to a wide variety, cover every subject of philosophical interest. We really have no specific worldview agenda on Dallas Philosophers Forum. We try to expose everything and hear it all and with an open mind. And so we're not, we've got those of us that serve on the board might have a particular, but there's no collective worldview that we all subscribe to, which is one of the things that makes it interesting to me. Let's see if I can think of any other business topics. We will introduce our speaker. We're very privileged tonight to have Ms. Sarah Fredericks. He's on the faculty of the University of North Texas in the Department of Philosophy and Religion Studies as an associate professor. Dr. Fredericks' work focuses on the subject of environmental ethics, and she published her first book, Measuring and Evaluating Sustainability, Ethics and Sustainability Indexes, last year, and is currently researching ethical implications of environmental guilt and shame, especially about climate change. She received her PhD from Boston University before coming here to North Texas to be with us. So let's give a warm Dallas welcome to Sarah Fredericks.
Opportunity to speak to all of you tonight. Is this loud enough? So in my presentation this evening, I'm going to focus on how attending to environmental guilt and shame can help environmental ethicists, philosophers, and environmentalists in general respond to and conceptualize environmental challenges. Particularly, I'll be looking at how guilt and shame combined with Hume's notion of causality can help us conceptualize one of the biggest intellectual hurdles of climate ethics, that of personal responsibility. So in order to accomplish this goal, I'd like to first give some evidence for the fact of environmental guilt and shame, as this is a topic not usually studied in the academic world or really anywhere. Next, I'd like to clarify the definition of these terms. Third, I'll introduce the problem of responsibility in climate ethics. And fourth, I'll offer my constructive solution, primarily, again, noting how Hume's causality is exemplified in the experience of many people who feel environmental guilt and shame and thus are able to get around problems of linear, rational causality and responsibility in climate ethics. Since this is an evening presentation, I thought I would start with a comic, and I know that the words are really small, so let me read them to you. Here's a woman at the grocery store, and she says, with this very wide-eyed look, I was using my bags to pick organic strawberries from my sustainable garden and then left them in my other car, a Prius, while I was busy helping underprivileged children install solar panels. So this incredible earnestness, the comic author calls eco-self-consciousness, the feeling of guilt, shame, and remorse for failing to bring your own reusable bags to the grocery store. Now, while this comic is poking fun at a certain demographic of the U.S. population, I argue that the very fact that there's a comic about this indicates that it's a real phenomenon that is present out there, and that whether or not we feel that, we can recognize that in probably people that we know. So in the last couple of years, I've been undertaking a study of popular media to try to document this phenomenon that really has not been studied very well. I have a paper that I had published recently that looked at conversations in blogs and discussion forums on websites. I looked at over 1,000 conversations and documented this type of response. I found that people feel guilt or shame around a whole host of activities that impact the environment, including forgetting their bags when they go to the grocery store, driving or flying in ways that they think are excessive, eating non-organic food, using toxic chemicals, disposable diapers, wasting water or electricity, just all kinds of everyday things. They're concerned about these actions for a whole host of reasons, some overlapping, some distinct, including the direct or indirect harms to themselves, their families, their communities, the harms to biota, possibly ecosystems or the planet, due to all of these types of activities. So here you see some book titles from some of the study in my expanded research in the last year. I Killed a Penguin, an Ecological Memoir, I'll be coming back to that. Confessions of an Eco-Sinner, Bad Green Guilt. Again, I would argue that in today's publishing world where it's so difficult to get books published, often the fact that there are so many indicates that this is a resonant topic with, again, at least a certain demographic. But I would argue that these feelings and recognition of them is actually spreading quite a bit. Major newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post have done articles featuring these subjects. We also have incredibly large home design websites like Apartment Therapy that has tens of thousands of readers every day that often features people being guilty about their use of energy or other materials in their homes. But Todayshow.com or Today.com and Oprah.com, other very large media conglomerates have featured this topic. And actually in January of 2014, Modern Family, one of the hit comedies today on primetime television, devoted a third of one of its episodes to this topic. So I realize that this is all a lot of qualitative information, but I argue that it points to the fact that guilt and shame about environmental issues are really significant. As an academic, of course, I wish to have actual numbers and studies, and there aren't very many out there yet. But one that's quite reputable was sponsored in part by National Geographic, and they found that 24 to 45% of people surveyed in 17 different countries around the world felt guilty about the impact they have on the environment. I also have looked at some dozen studies, usually done by market research firms, to figure out how to help corporations sell their products. And they found that 24 to 78% of people, usually in the U.S., Canada, or Great Britain, feel some sort of guilt about their environmental activities. Now, as I've been giving all of this research, the one thing I haven't done yet is conceptualize exactly what guilt and shame mean. And I've got to say, is it working again?
Well, something went out.
Okay.
That was sudden.
It was.
Just keep going.
Okay. in our common English language, if you ask people, what does guilt mean? What does shame mean? People don't have a standard answer. This has been documented over and over again. And if you look at the many academic disciplines, psychology, religious studies, philosophy, legal studies, that talk about guilt and shame, similarly, researchers have lots and lots and lots of different definitions. The ones that I work with in this project, or I have been working with, are based on the work of Helen Block Lewis in the 70s and 80s, and then a widespread new vision of guilt and shame based on that in the last couple of decades, primarily the work of June Price Tangney and her colleagues. So what they're talking about are self-conscious moral emotions. You're thinking about yourself. Here they talk about guilt as look at what I... Look at what I did. It's focusing on a particular action, whereas shame in their system focuses on a judgment about what they call the global self. And they usually talk about that as look at what I did, that I am a problematic person as a whole because of this action, rather than, oh, well, I messed up this time, I did something wrong, etc. So it's a behavior and its consequences versus one's identity. The reason why I use this differentiation is because it seems like it's really gained traction in the psychological literature, and because it maps really well onto the studies of environmental guilt and shame that I've been doing so far. Now, a few more characteristics of these moral emotions is that guilt, in this sense, tends to be relatively short-term. You feel bad because, you said something mean to your friend or family member, but it was a small thing, and they get over it, and you're okay, you apologize. Whereas shame tends to linger for a long time as you're assessing that you yourself are really problematic. In this system, a lot of psychological research has indicated that guilt is something that tends to provoke people to take action. You think that you actually can do something different because the problem is just something you did once. Whereas shame tends to be so problematic that people often want to hide. You'll see account after account after account of people talking about wanting to run away or not talk to the person they harmed or to cover their face or to cringe. I would guess that most of us have had a similar experience where we did something and then we didn't even want to talk to the person that we harmed. Okay, so that's what's happening here. Sometimes this type of shame can also provoke feelings of anger in that people are so upset and distraught about it. Now, what we've been talking about so far is individual guilt and individual shame, but the research by contemporary moral psychologists and also studies of collective action, say, German responses post-World War II to the atrocities that were committed by the German state and many of its individuals, or people in South Africa during and post-apartheid, or contemporary Israelis and Palestinians, or people in Northern Ireland, or people in Australia concerned about historic treatment of Aborigines, have all talked about collective guilt and collective shame. And what's happening here is that people identify with a group, they have a vision of morality that they themselves assent to. So it's not just something put onto them from the outside, but they agree with it. And then someone or multiple people in that group goes against these rules in some way. And then people in that group feel bad, either guilt or shame, because of what their group members have done. Interestingly, sometimes these feelings of guilt or shame come about because of things that have been done long in the past. So, for example, there have been studies of contemporary Germans born well after World War II who still feel a residual problematic feeling about what their ancestors did. And you see this really all over the world, and it appears to be a growing worldwide phenomenon. So here the contrast is look at what we did versus look at what we did. Again, it's a focus on an action versus a focus on a judgment about the group as a whole. Collective guilt tends to be a little bit more operative, not only when it's focused on an action, but when an individual has relatively weak ties to the group. It's easier to disassociate from the group or to think it's just a one-off problem. Whereas shame seems to come about more the more closely you are tied into that group with your own identity and the identity of that group. And as with the individual problems, guilt tends to provoke communities to seek some sort of reparations, to make formal apologies, to do some sort of restitution, whereas shame often provokes avoidance or denial. We aren't going to deal with this. There's no problem. It's the victim's fault. We didn't really do anything wrong. Now, my argument is that these four categories also map onto contemporary feelings of environmental guilt and shame. And I, of course, stopped looking at my notes and now I need them for a second. Okay, so when I was doing this analysis of online communications, I found that some of them focused on individual guilt. So people were saying, you know, I keep forgetting to bring my canvas bags when I go to the grocery store. What mechanism can I use to get over this? It felt bad, but they were focused on an action. Whereas other people, after the same action, would say, how is this possible? They really had an existential crisis to say, I can't even do the most basic thing of recycle or bring my bags. How can I ever hope to make a difference? What does this mean about me as a human or about humanity in general? So they're assessing their identity. Similarly, we see examples of collective guilt and collective shame in the literature. One really nice example of collective guilt comes in this book, Confessions of an Eco-Sinner. It's a little bit blurry if you're up close, but Fred Pierce wrote this book to investigate the origins of all of his stuff, his food, his clothes, his home, his transportation, to see what environmental and social impacts they had. So what did it really mean that his shirt was coming from a factory where sweatshop workers were making it? And in this book, with a lot of environmental and social investigations, he says, if Westerners like me had carbon emissions like that of the average Chinese, there would be no climate change problem right now. Now, he wrote the book a few years ago, and I'm not quite sure that I agree with his calculations, but the reason why I think this quote is interesting in the context of this conversation is that he's identifying himself with Westerners in general to say, we are the problem. Not just me, but I'm a part of this larger issue. He's identifying here and throughout the book his feelings of guilt and shame about things that started before he was born, about political decisions and conversations he probably really didn't have the opportunity to affect in a significant way. And he sees himself as guilty or complicit in this. Thus, he has done a lot to try to change his own actions. He's written a book. He's tried to be more politically active in order to take action. What I would argue as a clear case of environmental guilt. Scholars such as Mark Ferguson and Nyla Branscombe have also found a lot of examples of collective guilt through their surveys and studies. They found that people indeed who feel collective guilt are more likely to be willing to engage in mitigation efforts like conserving energy or paying green taxes than those who did not feel guilty.
So we've got not only the evidence that this is happening, but also that it's tracking along the action or hiding, as we would expect. There hasn't been, quite frankly, quite as much research about collective shame yet, but what I've got seems to indicate that it is also occurring among environmentalists as, and this is the part that's rather speculative at this point, but I'm sure I'll say it. My guess is that some of the reticence to address climate change on a national and international level comes about actually because of shame, that people can't believe that they participated in such a horrific process and don't even want to acknowledge it, and so they go in another direction. Now, I don't claim that that's the case for everybody, but I think that it's one of many operative pieces, and I'm working to try to document it. So, hopefully by now I've given you enough evidence that you can generally agree that these things exist, you know about the different definitions, and now I'd like to talk about the implications of these phenomena. What I'm presenting to you today is a part of a much longer project. It will probably be my next book, that's the hope. And I have at least these four implications. I'd like to focus on the fourth, but just mention the first three briefly. First, if it is the case that environmental guilt motivates productive actions and environmental shame can undercut hope or productive action, I think this is really important for environmentalists to know about and pay attention to. I'm not necessarily saying that we should try to guilt people into doing things, but I think people need to be aware that major corporations are trying to use that tactic quite a bit, and that these feelings are indeed out there and may hinder people's ability to participate in environmental movements. Secondly, both environmental guilt and shame, in my mind, call for a much broader approach to environmentalism. A lot of the times when I read environmental ethics, it seems to be what I sometimes call a naked ethic, that it's just the environmental principles, the values, or the virtues, but it doesn't have a deeper metaphysic or ontology or theory of relationality or how people are to actually live this in the world. And I think that the deep experiences of guilt and shame indicate that we need more than just the rules of what you're supposed to do. We have to be able to deal with what happens when people don't live up to those rules, how that affects them psychologically, how that affects them socially, and then how eventually that affects the economy or the environment, etc. So dealing with human limitations and failures. My third point is one that, is really particular to environmental ethics. A variety of ethicists in the last couple of years, Donald Brown, Gene Hargrove, and others, have lamented in print that environmental ethics hasn't had much of an impact. And often, why people are making this claim is they say, well, we haven't stopped climate change. We haven't even made significant inroads. Environmental ethics is failing. And I agree, it's not doing as much about climate change as one might hope. But I think that the existence of guilt and shame actually tells us that environmental ethics is penetrating into the ethical systems of a wide variety of people. Something that I don't think people would have been feeling bad in the same way 20 or 30 or 40 years ago about this stuff. So I think it's an indication of the overall ethic of the country shifting. But finally, it's number four that I'd like to talk to you more about today. This is a new implication, and I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts about it. So one of the most significant philosophical effects of paying attention to these moral emotions, I want to argue, is that it starts dissolving one of the big intellectual hurdles of climate ethics, that of responsibility. Most environmental philosophers have approached the question of climate ethics by analogy with traditional cases, where you have very clear and direct linear causal chains. So, for example, if I walked out into the audience and I kicked one of you in the shin, this would be a problem. I would be responsible for your pain and my damaged reputation as a speaker. It's mine. I did it. I kick you. Analogously, in the environmental realm, if I store hazardous wastes in leaky barrels near my property line, it leaks into the water table and contaminates your well, I did it. Now, it's a little bit harder sometimes to connect the dots of causal chains in groundwater leaks, I recognize, but there's that sort of direct causation. And I think environmental philosophy is fairly well poised to deal with those types of challenges. But climate change is something different. There's not always this direct causal chain between action and harm. Also in climate change, it's not just about an individual or a tightly defined community, like a corporate entity. Often the people that are responsible, or the ethicists want to claim are responsible, is a very diffuse group. And this diffuse group is something that is really tough for people to get their mind around. And I argue that ethicists keep using these old tools for a new problem. So let's talk about climate change. It's really complex. The effects of individual molecules aren't able to be traced. So the cooks in the kitchen, maybe they were using a gas stove tonight. Maybe they were using a gas stove as they cooked my food. I can't trace those exact molecules of carbon dioxide to see if they were up or taken in by trees outside, or if they go into the atmosphere and stay there for 10 years or 20 years or 1,000 years. I know that they're out there, but I can't do that direct causal chain. Of course, the issue of climate change is also an issue of an aggregated problem. If I was the only one using fossil fuels in the whole world, chances are high that I couldn't use them at a, or wouldn't use them at a rate that would make climate change a problem. It's a challenge because so many people are using so much at such significant rates. Now, when ethicists start analyzing these issues, some say that because we don't have a direct causal chain from the molecules coming out of my stove to climate change or a flood or the thermometer increasing somewhere, that I can't be held personally responsible. That's the end of the story. We need to do something else. Others focus on another part of the problem, this problem of aggregation. They argue that maybe the fact that these things are limited means that no individual human has individual responsibility. For some, this means, excellent, we don't actually have to worry about climate change, we aren't responsible, we don't need to do anything. But others want to preserve some sort of ethic or responsibility and try to figure out a way of doing that. One of these scholars is a major climate ethicist named Dale Jamieson, and he argues that we can't really talk about individual responsibility. And instead, he moves to virtue ethics, saying that people should seek to be the virtuous person and not actually worry about whether they're individually responsible or not. I have some challenges with Jamieson's point of view, which I'll be talking about in a little bit, but at the moment I'd like to talk about the fact that he and many other people have a very rationalistic analysis of these things. It's very linear, it's very deterministic, it's very focused on direct causation. And some people have begun to critique this. For example, my colleague Baird Callicott, in his new book, Thinking Like a Planet, has pointed out the problems with the rationality and individuality of these types of arguments like Jamieson's. But when I read Baird's work, I think, this is great, but you haven't quite diagnosed all of the problems. One other issue that exists is this problem of the linear causal chain. I don't think that the lack of such a direct chain from my molecules cooking my food to climate change should be a sufficient condition to disrupt responsibility at either the individual or collective level. I think that individuals and collectives do have a responsibility for the problem and ought to do something about it. And I think keeping responsibility in the conversation, unlike Jameson, who wants to just chuck it and focus on virtue ethics, is problematic rhetorically. So I think responsibility does a lot of work in our political and civil conversations. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. I'd like to move back to think about this theory of causation underlying these arguments. These arguments about personal responsibility assume that a known and well-understood linear chain of events that exactly contributes to the problem is necessary for responsibility. They don't have a place for probabilities or uncertainties in their arguments. Furthermore, they're generally focused on the individual as the main, if not only, level of analysis. And to me, this just seems problematic as a mode of analysis altogether. It seems like they're taking all of the stereotypes of what it means to be modern and refusing to break out of them. So I say, well, this isn't the only way to look at causation. Indeed, Hume, this major thinker, has an alternative theory of causation, and the narratives that I read about environmental guilt and shame make me think that people in their everyday lives are actually using something akin to Hume's theory. So let me talk about this a little bit more. Now, in case it's been a while since you've thought about Hume, let me just review it in brief. Hume claims that what we call causation arises not from direct necessary connections between what we call causes and what we call effects, but the constant conjunction of events that follow each other. So to go back to the silly example I said earlier, if I was to walk into the audience and kick one of you in the shin, most of you would say, "You did it, you hurt me." Well, Hume would say, you make this claim because so many times in your life, you've seen someone's foot go out, you've seen it strike your leg or your arm or something else, and you felt pain, and you assumed that one leads to the other. But he says this following, this constant conjunction, does not actually necessitate that one is causing the other. I realize this is a little silly example, but I think it can help just make sure we know what we're talking about. Now, sometimes when people first encounter Hume, they say, oh, does this mean that there's no causation at all? How are we supposed to live our lives? Well, as again, I would guess many of you know, Hume argues that in fact, we use this constant conjunction of events to guide all sorts of decision making. Do we sit in a chair and expect that it will hold our weight? Do we get in our cars later and drive home expecting that they will work? Do we think that the sun will rise again? Yes, of course, all of these things. But when we step back to reflect on these things philosophically, we can't quite know. Taking Hume seriously, when I read the work of many climate scholars, I see them reifying direct causality to the point that if they can't trace the causal chain, they feel that they can't talk about responsibility at all, and that they can't talk about fault or blame or anything else. To me, this is a reification of causality beyond what really needs to happen. I've talked about some examples of this in the past, and here I want to return to climate ethicist Dale Jameson. If you read his recent book, Reason in a Dark Time, which I've got to say is really a wonderful and well-done book, very nice, but I do have this little quibble with it, it's that throughout the book, he keeps returning to the theme of responsibility. In my read of his work, he wants there to be individual responsibility for climate change, but he can't figure it out. And I diagnose this as he can't figure it out because he has to have linear causality for his vision of responsibility. So about 80 or 90% of the way through the book, he says, okay, responsibility, we just can't do that. Let's turn to virtue ethics in this really abrupt move. I think virtue ethics could be fine and helpful, but I'm not sure that we need to chuck out all of responsibility. think there's another answer here that at minimum fills in these missing steps of Jameson's work and possibly sets up conditions for an idea of causation that is more humble and more robust in that it can deal with the dynamic complexities of something like climate change. So namely, we look to the scientists who observe the constant conjunction of increased greenhouse gases in the atmosphere with temperature rise, sea level rise, and a host of other environmental changes. Data is quite reliable and people know it with a very high degree of confidence. Thus, we can take it as a guiding principle of life that such a conjunction will continue even if we have philosophical questions about cause and effect. Now, quite frankly, if I can make an aside here, I will say that in putting this paper together and thinking about it, one of the challenges for me has been whether I really actually want to use causality here, because I'm hesitant about saying, oh, causality, I'm not sure about that, because I don't want to give climate deniers another reason to say, well, we shouldn't care about climate change if we can't actually care about causation. Okay, let me come back to you. But I think that if we follow Hume, we don't have to fully give up cause and effect. We can have this constant conjunction and just in our work try to stop its reification. I think that we know we're reifying cause and effect when the need for a direct causal chain interferes with the analysis of problems that we do participate in, such as our contributions to climate change. So moving back to environmental guilt and shame, we see that there are people with these moral emotions that can imagine the causal connections even if they are probabilistic and not direct. For example, in the introduction to her ecological memoir, Fritzi von Jessen describes reading an article about the effects of climate change on penguins. Specifically, she reads that their habitat and access to food is disrupted or lost due to melting ice. So many penguins are killed that several species are threatened. After reading this article, von Jessen reflects on her own habits of just very mundane activities, driving to the grocery store, buying food wrapped in plastic packaging, lighting her grill with lighter fluid, all activities which are giving off greenhouse gases. And she finds herself wondering, have I killed a penguin? The result of this moral imagination and reflection is strong enough for her to write an entire book about her quest to be a better environmentalist and to help others in their own quest. Her care for far-off penguins and her recognition of her identity as one who, along with many others, contributes to environmental degradation, including the loss of penguin habitat, leads her to this conclusion, even though it's clear throughout the book that she's not actually presuming that the molecules from her grill are going over and killing the penguins. She doesn't need to know that. It's enough for her to know that she emits the gases, that the emission of the gases on a large scale has been repeatedly conjoined to the host of global and local environmental effects, including penguin deaths. In other words, I would argue that the experiential common sense morality leading to her guilt and shame does not require an exact, linear, individualized account of cause and effect. Indeed, a wide variety of scholars of guilt and shame, including Sammy Filstrom and a lot of traditional accounts of guilt and shame in, say, China, argue that feeling these moral emotions can be a clue as to a person's morality even if they have not yet explicitly articulated their moral principles, values, or virtues even to themselves. So Filstrom, in his contemporary analysis, and a variety of cultures around the world have argued that feeling guilt and shame is a good sign of your actual morality, and that when you feel those twinges, it's a signal that you need to step back and say, whoa, what's going on here? They argue, and I would tend to agree, that such moral emotions are particularly important for devising new moral strategies to really radically new problems, like those that we encounter with climate change, that are so complex, so dynamic, over such significant spatial and temporal scales that we really haven't encountered before. So, why does all of this matter?
Well, I think it turns us ethicists to the experience of everyday people as a source of ethics. Now, I don't want to say that we should just survey people for all ideas of right and wrong, but I do think that these experiences of guilt and shame can tune us in to new types or new ways of approaching moral problems that we might not have had before. I think that relying on them can allow us a broader resource base for developing ethics, and I think it can help us avoid getting stuck in the dead ends of this extreme rationality or linear causation, or only focusing on individuals. So I think that paying attention to such moral emotions can help us get out of this reification and allow us to respect and value the people doing these moral activities and have better philosophical reflection. And I think this broader base is really necessary when dealing with these new, very complex problems. Now granted, this is just one of the reasons why I think looking at environmental guilt and shame is interesting for philosophers, ethicists, or environmentalists, but it's the one that I chose to talk to you about tonight, and I'm interested to hear what all of you think. Thank you.
I got one quick one. Could you define reification?
Yeah, thanks. I'd like to get some water. Reification is when you put an idea or an object or an event or a person, what you might say, on a pedestal. You reify it. You take it as extreme and absolute. You're unwilling to challenge it. You might take it as, in this case, when we're talking about ideas, so much of an assumption that you don't ever even think, you don't even realize it's an assumption that you have. It becomes one of the most important things in your worldview or in your philosophy. You may recognize that, you may not. It's a term that's often used in religious studies. It comes particularly from Buddhist analysis, where people are putting something of the world up as the most important, and then that causes suffering. But it's used in a variety of places.
Okay.
Thanks.
If I follow you correctly, I would assume that there is implication in one of the hurdles in making the transition to, I would call it a, perhaps you would, a communal ethic. Mm-hmm. Is our American Western investment, extreme investment in individuality and individual freedom, mm-hmm. individual responsibilities. Those are all good, but they're also a, if you understand me correctly, those are also a problem.
Yes, I think it is, I think there are a lot of really great things about individual responsibility and individual freedoms, but I think that if we only focus on the individual, then we don't have a way to conceptualize group guilt or shame or responsibility. And I think that when we look at climate change, it's a group thing. It's not just that it's my emissions plus your emissions, it's the fact that all of us have a system where we have roads and we have air conditioning and we have political systems that are set up to enable it or allow it, and all of that stuff is operative at levels much larger than the individual. So I think you're right, if we focus just on the individual, we can't even talk about the problem in all of the ways that we need to.
I know we speak of all mankind, or all Americans, or all Texans, but there's really not such an entity. We're all individuals and made up of individuals. And so we tend to rationalize, like, what difference would I make? What difference does my little saving some water or driving a big car make, you know, among billions. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of rationalize away our guilt or shame.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, and then, so the government or its imposed morals upon us, increase taxes, increase your water bill, increase the cost of gasoline to try to, you know, moderate those morals or whatever. So my question is, how much does education or change from the bottom up versus an imposition from the top of morals, you know, from the government to change attitudes?
I think this is a great question. I think that a lot of change does come from the bottom and needs to come from the bottom. And I think that when people say, oh, well, it doesn't really matter if I recycle or not, it's such a small drop in the bucket compared to everybody. Well, first, you have the fact that if everyone does it, it's more than a drop in the bucket. And secondly, you have the indirect education and the changing of culture, where if one person does it, then their friends and family might start get habituated to that as being normal. You also have formal education that I think can be very instructive in changing morality. And I also think that some things need to come from the top down, because some types of physical infrastructure doesn't change without different laws or different policies put into place.
Brian first.
Okay, well, that picture on the wall is sort of staring me in the face, and I wonder if Fritz Elon Jessen knows that the reason why some of the penguins are threatened is because over the past half century, the hunting of whales has stopped, and so the whale population's increased, and it's using up a great deal of the krill that the penguins feed on. So in fact, the environmental efforts to stop killing the whales have backfired and caused this another problem. That's one comment I had, and I see you nodding your head, so I guess you...
I'm not sure what she knows. I don't know everything that is in her mind,
right.
But I definitely agree with you that the problems are very intricate, and that often previous attempts to try to help something have caused new and unprecedented problems.
That's right, and there was another one with regard to biofuels, too, that resulted in cutting down a lot of forests and putting up the price of food.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, it seems to me, you know, I agree with you that we need to preserve the environment, and we need and these creatures are precious creatures. The main problem, though, is not using plastic bags rather than using canvas bags, you know, at the supermarket. It's because the world population is increasing, and the more people there are, the more damage they do to the environment, the more it gets turned into places for growing food and so on. And yet I see very little activity on the part of environmentalists to try and counter the very strong religious opposition to efforts to provide birth control capabilities for the millions of women around the world who really want it.
This is a very rich question. I hope to get at the different parts. First of all, I definitely agree with you that there are things that are much, much more effective than spending all of your time worrying about taking a plastic bag or a paper bag or your cloth bag or just holding your groceries. I agree. And I find a lot of that rhetoric really annoying, because it's focusing attention on individuals and these teeny weeny little things rather than what could actually make the most difference. It's not efficient, it's not as effective. That individualized rhetoric doesn't talk about political change very much, and frankly, it drives me crazy a lot. But I think to get back to this first question, one of the challenges is that rhetoric comes out of our incredibly individualized notion of who our self is, such that when people are thinking about what they can do, they often just think about their household or their day-to-day activities. And so to get to the last part of your question about, or a piece of it, about how environmentalists are acting, I think one of the biggest challenges for environmentalists is to think about shifting worldviews from just about individuals to about collectives. And how to go about that is a question that I don't have an answer to.
The problem, as you put it, I think does have a philosophical answer, not necessarily a practical one.
Yeah.
But Immanuel Kant's concept that I ought to always choose to do that which I would want everyone else in the world to do. Mm-hmm. In other words, the only way I as an individual can make any kind of contribution is through myself. And so I should always act as if I would want everyone else in the world to act the same way. And if I, you know, and if we could get all people to do that through education and so forth, then we might have a chance to do something about the environment. Yeah. So I think Kant had the answer.
I think Kant definitely does have an answer. The challenge that I find in things like the categorical imperative, which you just spoke about, or other ethical precepts, is that so often they tell us what we should do, and then they leave out the part of the story when we don't live up to those expectations. And so I find that this study of environmental guilt and shame is refocusing my attention on human limits. Philosophers sometimes talk about it as limits of the will, what happens when you don't do what you think you should, and what are the ramifications of that. And so I agree with you, if everybody followed that, the world would probably be pretty awesome. But I haven't seen that instantiated in the world. No, and so I'm curious about how to deal with those limits.
Well, I see the only other option is fascism. That you make people do it. So if you still wanted the democratic, individual, type of life, then you have to use the categorical imperative.
I have another question.
Gilman here. You've done a good analysis of guilt and shame and the nature of them and the difference, but really, shouldn't we just let them do their job and, hooray for guilt and shame because it changes things. I mean, look at, slavery. There's something a lot of people did not want to even think about changing, and they eventually felt various degrees of guilt and shame getting lectures from friends and all that stuff that's always going to be here.
Yeah.
Let it do its job. I'm not sure it matters that much how they work.
As I've been getting into the larger project much more, there are often times when I agree with you that these have real functions in society. There's a lot going on in evolutionary psychology to talk about how guilt and shame promote group cohesion, reparations, apologies, these types of things, and actual action. And I think all of that can be great. I worry a little bit about how that might get co-opted in marketing or in the political sphere. And I also worry a little bit if people don't pay attention to the psychosocial effects of not living up to expectations. I think that so much of the environmental movement talks about the social sphere as really physical aspects, and I think that this literature indicates that there's something, it reminds us that there's something more to being a human, and that that needs to be taken account if we're having a full and rich environmental philosophy.
Just one comment. When you've been talking about the United States, it seems, which is the rest of the world, and I just comment there is just, I think you got a lot of cultural implications that play into the whole guilt and shame aspect and how that's there, so that's just one piece, but my question here, and there might be a follow-up depending on the answer, is your contention kind of to maybe utilize guilt, based on your slides earlier, as a way to emphasize this movement for global climate change or making better decisions for the climate?
Thanks. I'd like to address both of these. First, I definitely recognize that there's a big cultural component. And in this short presentation today, I was focusing on the U.S. Because once you start looking at a multitude of cultures, the challenges of defining guilt and shame are made exponentially more difficult. Also, quite frankly, most of the research that I've been able to access is on the U.S., Canada, and Great Britain. And so that limits my study. But it's definitely something I'm keeping in mind. As to utilizing guilt, I haven't fully articulated to myself how I would want to use it or not use it. The literature is so sparse. Most of what I've worked on so far is documentation and figuring out the possible implications of this. I'm still really working through what I think are all of the normative judgments I would want to make about it. As I mentioned a little bit earlier, I think that it's just a fact that these moral emotions are there and that they are, especially guilt, can be useful for environmental change. I'm wary of that, though, because of the possibilities for manipulation. And so I think were that to be used in some way, it has to be done in a really careful way. And I don't have a full answer yet on that one.
Other questions?
I guess one thing, the definition of guilt and shame, very hard to pin down. And for everybody, you know, and depending on where you are in the state, in the country, in the world, changes dramatically. And it just seems to me like you have forces and monetary entities, whether collectively or individually, are trying to change our perspective of guilt and shame, gaming it, so that what was before was inappropriate is now no big deal. And then what tomorrow will be inappropriate will be no big deal down the road. And they just keep moving the bar.
Yeah.
And like my brother worked for the Smithsonian, and a friend of mine was saying, well, so what if these things are going extinct? You know, they're just animals, who cares? And now it's like that's this smooth bar a little further.
Yeah.
As we see these extinctions going on. To me, it seems that that's got to be part of the study, is to look at where the student money is being thrown on both sides, and how that changes the definition of guilt and shame.
I definitely agree. I would want to shift the language a little bit to say not just changing the definition of guilt and shame, but changing what guilt and shame are applied to, or the realm of guilt and shame. And I think tracing the finances is a really important piece of that. And I also think that your comments about widening the sphere of what guilt and shame are applied to is really apt. One of the most striking things I've read in doing this study, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the scholar who did it, but he was, or she, can't even remember that, was talking about the expanding sense of morality in the last several hundred years, that now environmental ethics are a concern. There's a more concern about civil rights. There's more concern about all sorts of things, and how the sense of what people have to be concerned about is frankly larger, and larger in quite a significant sense than just a few generations ago. Now, obviously, not everybody has this broadened sphere, But this particular author was talking about the challenges that that poses to society, and I think that that is an important part of the analysis, not just to look at the money, but also to say, how does this shape society when we now have other things we do feel guilty about than maybe our grandparents did?
Any others?
When I'm thinking about choices, I think behavior change, and so I'm wondering if you have any examples of messages that have come out recently that include guilt and shame. And I guess because talking about this, I'm remembering a commercial of a Native American with a tear running down his cheek, talking about the environment. And to me, that I was 8, 9, 10. And that still strikes me today, and I feel like maybe that was tapping into that.
I think,
are there any current examples?
In a way, there are so many current examples, it's hard to put my finger on just one. One thing I really see in commercials particularly is advertisers or marketers playing on guilt or shame that women have about the way that they're raising their families. That if you don't buy this organic baby food for your kid, you're really giving them a disadvantage. If they don't have the non-toxic wooden handcrafted toys, then you're being a bad mom. And that's the seat of a lot of this conversation, or a lot of the marketing that I've seen is about mothers and children. And it's often very gendered. And indeed, a lot of the conversation of people talking about this is very gendered. It's predominantly women talking about these experiences. I don't want to say all of them, but a lot of them are.
Yeah. Okay, what's the last question? Oh, there we go.
I always seem to get a little higher concerned when someone brings up guilt and shame.
Yeah.
You've heard about the salesman who was able to sell Eskimos.
Yeah.
And saying to Arabia,
yeah.
Well, guilt and shame many times used to sell public policy.
Yeah.
So when you look at climate changes, many of which happen naturally on Earth and are very violent, much more violent than most of man's actions have ever been on the environment, the natural environmental climate change that happens is. So, when you start saying guilt and shame, I think, what's the public policy that's going to be sold to us now?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of guilt and shame are they going to try to link it to? It just, red flags go all the way around.
Yeah.
It can also be used to set major environmental climate change actions. Is it global public policy?
Can you get to the question?
My question is, how do you, or do you want to stay on the individual level of guilt and shame, or how do you transport this to the global policy making level of perhaps causing major changes in the earth so that a greater disaster will not happen, like Yellowstone? Can we deactivate the powerful forces of what horrible things might happen if Yellowstone goes off by doing a major global policy change? Or do you just want to keep it on the individual?
I'm interested in individual and collective guilt.
really, rather than provoking guilt, I'm interested in drawing attention to guilt and shame as issues of ethical concern. That I don't think enough people have paid attention to the way that guilt and shame about environmental issues have played a role in marketing. And I think that we need to analyze that and be aware of that as we are consumers, as we are educators, as we are citizens, as we are voters, as we are raising families or dealing with our friends' children. And I think that to be more aware of how that rhetoric is used by any side of the debate is something to take into account.
Mm-hmm. Now, on that note, let's thank Dr. Frederick for next week's presentation.